Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. Authoritarian regimes around the world are having a renewed impact on American politics. Whether it's the nuclear threat from North Korea, the presidential crisis in Venezuela, or the ongoing conflict in Syria. Some fear that the Trump administration is making that impact worse. Then there is the president's stance toward Russia, a country with authoritarian tendencies that has interfered with our elections, and is probably going to do so again. Crosscut invited experts on Russia, Africa, and Central America to discuss all of this global unrest, the Trump administration's role in it, and what threats it might pose to American democracy. Michael Camilleri is director of the Peter D. Bell Rule of Law Program at the Inter-American Dialogue. An international lawyer and former diplomat, he served from 2012 to 2017 in the Obama administration as the Western Hemisphere advisor on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff and as director for Andean Affairs at the National Security Council. Jackie Miller is president and CEO of the World Affairs Council of Seattle. She serves on several committees and think tanks, including the Council on Foreign Relations and the Washington State Advisory Committee for the U.S. Global Leadership Coalition. She's also been a visiting scholar and fellow in Russia and Kyrgyzstan. Connie G. Anthony is a professor of political science at Seattle University. She specializes in international relations with a focus on the developing world and has taught courses and published research on Africa's history, political economy, and development. Crosscut senior correspondent Enrique Cerna moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and the Washington Policy Center. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Hello. Say hello, Mr. Cerna. How's that?
You're right.
Yeah, thank you. I like that. I am not Doug Baldwin, but I wish I was at one point. I like the way that guy plays. Welcome to a conversation that I think is fairly timely, considering what's happening in the world today, although our news does seem to change every 5 minutes or so, usually sometimes less than that. I'd like to begin with my folks here. Let's talk about the state of our democracy, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about what do you see as the good, the bad, and what you think might be the ugly of democracy in America today. And Michael, let's start with you.
Thanks, Enrique. It's great to be here. It's such a wonderful event, and I can't wait to get back to D.C. and tell people I spoke on a panel in jeans. So great to really, really grateful for the invitation.
It's a Seattle thing. You can do that. Yeah, although I wore slacks. So what the heck?
Look, I think U.S. democracy is still strong, but maybe not as strong as we thought it was. And the temptation is to start and end that conversation with Donald Trump. And I'm certainly of the view that he is doing significant damage to our democratic discourse and culture. But I'm also of the view, which is not an original one, that he's more the symptom than the disease. That he is exploiting vulnerabilities in our democracy rather than generating them. And I think these systemic vulnerabilities really have to do with political polarization, verging on tribalism, with state capture by special interests, and as a consequence, a political system that's viewed by many Americans as gridlocked, as unresponsive, and ultimately, as Trump said, rigged. And I think these vulnerabilities have their roots in political and economic and technological changes, everything from partisan gerrymandering to an information environment that's producing filter bubbles and a kind of post-truth politics, as well as deindustrialization. So I think, what Trump has done is expose the degree to which our political system needs some updating, some kind of rewiring, and the extent to which these vulnerabilities that have emerged and have kind of been untended in our democratic culture and infrastructure have left us vulnerable to leaders, politicians, and most prominently our current president, with little regard for the kind of unwritten norms that we, I think, for a long time took for granted, as well as some instincts that are clearly of the authoritarian variety. And I think we continue to neglect those things at our peril.
Jackie.
So I'm the one that told Michael it was okay to wear jeans. I share Michael's concern about the surprising fragility of our democracy and how easy it has been for foreign powers to exploit that. You said the good, the bad, and the ugly, and I'll hit the good last, kind of because it's the hardest. But the erosion of transparency is really, really startling. It has been over 800 days since the United States president has held a formal press conference. It has been over 50 days since his press secretary has held a press briefing. The briefing she held a couple weeks ago for kids visiting the White House does not count. A lack of transparency and access to decision makers. The undermining of free press, the demonization of the media is a huge concern to me. The erosion of checks and balances. We're supposed to have three parts of government that are separate but equal. And we don't have that anymore. We have a Congress that has abdicated its fundamental role, and we have a judiciary that is being politicized. And we have, within the administration, an unwillingness to speak truth to power. If you speak truth to power, you are no longer in the administration. The administration is a more like-minded than is healthy. That's the bad. The ugly is...
Yay.
I am an optimist by nature. The ugly is allowing a foreign power to interfere in our electoral process. And that, as I said, our democracy is more fragile than we thought. And Russia didn't create the divisions in our society, but they've exploited them efficiently and cheaply, and they've been aided and abetted by the administration. So the good, I have a good, and hear me out, because I want to focus on the foreign policy aspect here of the U.S. system. And the good right now on foreign policy in terms of our democracy is Congress. Yeah, no clapping for that.
We're waiting.
You're waiting, right. So it's really hard for Congress to have a role in foreign policy, right? The foreign policy usually is in the hands of the executive. But this Congress and the Congress before it, despite Republican leadership, has tried to claw back a role for Congress and to temper some of the worst instincts of this president. First thing to look at, budget. The international affairs budget, the administration has tried to gut every year, 33% or more cuts to the foreign affairs budget, which is less than 1% of our overall budget. Congress has restored that funding, in the case of fiscal year 2019, slightly increased funding over 2018, despite what the president wanted. That is good. Russia, sanctions. Congress made it so that this president could not roll back sanctions on Russia without Congress's approval. So what the president may have wanted to do for Russia and roll back sanctions, which is what Vladimir Putin desperately wants, he no longer has that ability. NATO. This president has called NATO obsolete, doesn't understand why we're still in it, thinks it's, the countries are not paying us for their defense, which is not how NATO works. But Congress also, both houses, passed resolutions that the president could not withdraw from NATO. Yemen. Congress invoked the War Powers Resolution for the first time on Yemen, a conflict that has killed 50,000 people and left 20 million people in need of assistance. And this Congress said, that's not okay. We are going to end our military role there. Of course, Trump vetoed that resolution, but it's a really, really important sign that Congress was willing to step up on that. And finally, on the Uyghurs in China, when human rights does not often come front and center for this administration, unless the administration is trying to use it as a cudgel, both houses of Congress have been pushing past resolutions for sanctions on the Uyghurs, and we're going to have a trade deal probably announced next week. But we've had Congress involved and trying to stand up for some of the key issues.
Connie.
Okay, I'm probably going to end up emphasizing the good. So democracy is something that you can measure. Its health can be measured in a variety of ways, and the way I've been thinking about it is in terms of elections, which we've all been watching, and how free and fair they are, rule of law, and a general respect for democratic political institutions. So I think one of the most impressive things that's come as a consequence of Trump being elected is the hashtag MeToo movement. And that has strengthened rule of law in a really important area. And for people of my generation, women, we know that, for example, when we were young, rape was never reported because you were advised by lawyers that it couldn't really be prosecuted. Sexual harassment in the workplace was something you just got your way through. And we have a new generation that's saying, wow, why did you do that? And so we now have laws that are being more carefully implemented. There's a much higher level of awareness. And it's possible we wouldn't be there if Trump hadn't been elected president. It's a bizarre, you know, backlash, but it's really moved things forward in gender relations. In terms of free and fair elections, I was really impressed with the congressional and Senate elections and excited by the fact that you had both many more people of color and also many more women who ran for office, and not just on the national level. So the state legislature in New York, for example, kind of flipped, and you now have these young progressive women assembly people who are bringing forward all kinds of different issues. You have huge numbers of people getting involved in politics in a way that really wasn't true before. And so while I totally agree with what Jackie just said about the Russians, and I think that you can only hope, given the current administration, that this is being done, and we're not really hearing about how carefully they're monitoring things, I also think that we wouldn't have seen this kind of flip in terms of who's willing to run for office and get involved in politics if Trump hadn't run the way that he did in terms of the number of people he insulted and the kinds of things he ignored. And frankly, every time he does that now, I just go, yes, because he's mobilizing people. And that is totally not a bad thing for our democracy. One of the most disturbing things, I think, if there's a bad that Trump has engendered and that was kind of already in place, it's that it's the legitimacy of our institutions and how people view what's going on and the level of alienation. And I think that was already there because I think some of those people did vote for the Republican Party. And I think liberals in this country, really, there hasn't been enough self-critique at how the Democratic Party walked away from bread and butter issues for lots of people in this country. We can, you know, live in Seattle or New York or Washington, D.C. and be part of that coastal elite, and we have wonderful tolerance, and I love that about Seattle. But there are people who are living with the opioid crisis in a way that it's hard to believe, given some of the drug problems in Seattle, that we're not. There are people who are living in parts of the country in which their whole generations of family worked at a particular industry, and that's gone now. And I want to see whoever runs Democratic have proposals on that. How are we going to address the fact that we now have many rural areas in which who are not connected to the national conversation because their lives are immiserated? Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have to address that in terms of many other parts of society. But I think that's an ugly piece, and economic inequality always, always, it doesn't matter where it shows up globally, it always undermines democracy. When you centralize wealth, that's it.
We should also note that Washington State, actually, when it comes to the elections and the change in our Washington State legislature with more women and more people of color, that there was a big shift there during the last election that we saw, and that also changed the majorities in our state legislature.
Yeah, no,
so we should point that out. Yeah. Let's talk about Venezuela, since it's been in the news this week. Michael, that's a kind of a specialty area, Latin America, for you. What does that, the crisis that's happening there, the move to try to overthrow Maduro, and what seemed like it was going to happen this week didn't happen, and also the fact that there seemed to be that the president and his secretary of state weren't on the same page. You know, one is saying that No, the Russians aren't going to go in. And then the other saying, hey, the Russians were they were the reason that Maduro did not leave the country, because they stopped him before he could go. So fill us in on that and your take.
Yeah, there's a lot there to unpack, and I'll try not to take up the rest of the hour. But
No, you won't.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah.
You got 30 seconds.
Right. No. So, I think I always like to start with, you know, just the basics on what we're seeing in Venezuela, which is a man-made economic, humanitarian, democratic crisis. This was a country that was one of the richest and one of the most democratically stable in Latin America, and its democratic institutions and economy have been sort of systematically dismantled and destroyed over the past couple decades, but especially over the past 5 years since Nicolas Maduro, who is just a hapless and useless, as well as kind of repressive leader, came to office. The kind of steady drip of authoritarian consolidation in Venezuela came to a head last year when he had himself fraudulently elected for a new term. And in January of this year, the opposition, which controls the National Assembly, put forward a new leader, Juan Guaido. And following the kind of constitutional order of succession, which is similar to ours in that it runs through the equivalent of the Speaker of the House, essentially argued that since there was no legitimate president due to these fraudulent elections, power should pass on an interim basis to Juan Guaido. It's not a perfect argument, but it's about as close as you can get to a democratically legitimate constitutional transition plan, given everything that's happened in the country. Guaido has the support of probably 70 or 80% of Venezuelans. He's got the recognition of almost 60 countries, including the U.S., most of Latin America, most of the EU. What he doesn't have is control over the army. And so you have this standoff. What happened this week, this past week, was that Guaido went on, not TV, because the TV's censored, but went on social media and with standing in front of a bunch of members of the military and said, you know, the military's flipped to me, and we're putting in place our transition plan. It's time for Maduro to go, and we're going to, you know, basically make this happen. Some of the people who he thought were going to flip to his side, including the Minister of Defense, didn't flip. They stayed loyal to Maduro. His people went out in the streets, but they were repressed, tear gassed, and beaten up by Maduro's folks. So so the standoff essentially continues. What it has revealed is that there were negotiations with a number of people at a pretty high level, by both Guaido and his allies, and apparently by some in the U.S. administration, trying to get them to sort of switch sides. That, I think, means that Maduro is going to be pretty nervous going forward, looking over his shoulder, looking around, wondering who's with him, who's not. It also probably means, unfortunately, he's going to be even more repressive and on a bit of a witch hunt to figure out, you know, who was in on this plot. Guaido is going to try to, you know, keep the momentum going, get his people out in the streets. He's called for a strike. So I think we're back in kind of a stalemate, but it's, if anything, a more volatile stalemate, one that's potentially more violent, and no closer I don't think, to kind of resolving this thing in a democratic and peaceful way, unfortunately. And I'll end just by saying something about U.S. policy, which of all the things the Trump administration has done on foreign policy, I think I'm more sympathetic to the approach on Venezuela, which has combined some unique U.S. capabilities with an uncharacteristically multilateral approach. But it has become a little bit kind of garbled in the last few weeks and a little bit impulsive. And as you said, Enrique, there were definitely some mixed messages around the role of Russia, the extent to which negotiations were happening and were advanced with some of these people that were close to Maduro. So I think the administration would be well served to talk a little bit less, do a little bit more, and especially do things in partnership with allies in the region and beyond who are working in concert for a peaceful and democratic outcome in Venezuela.
So as part of this, if we look at what happened yesterday, the president saying that he had a conversation by phone with Vladimir Putin talking about Venezuela and said that he was not planning anything there. Also mentioned the fact that he had nothing to do with, he did not speak with him about the interference in our elections in 2016 and beyond. What does that say about what this relationship that our president, the leader of the free world, and the concern you have of him dealing with a dictator in Russia, as well as also reaching out and praising someone like Kim Jong-un in North Korea? I mean, what does that tell us about our foreign policy, or what is the foreign policy, and what does that mean to our democracy? Who wants to pick up on that?
I can jump in, start on that, and then have my co-panelists jump in as well. So Trump likes Putin, thinks he's a strong leader, has great control over his country, believes what Putin says over what the U.S. intelligence community says. And it's not just praise of Putin that we've seen. It's praise of Kim, who he calls a smart cookie. And keep in mind that they fell in love. I don't remember if that was Singapore or Hanoi. But they did fall in love. It was a beautiful thing.
You can't help yourself, can you? Here we go.
We've
gone from Rocket Man to having a beautiful thing. So there we go. Yeah.
But it's not just Putin and Kim that he's enamored with, right? Erdogan, of Turkey. Shortly after Erdogan, security forces beat up protesters on U.S. soil. He said Erdogan is becoming a friend. Duterte, who's doing a boatload of extrajudicial killings in the Philippines, said he's doing a heck of a job. Sisi is a fantastic guy in Egypt, also has good shoes, according to Trump.
Probably does.
Yeah, I'm guessing Gucci or something. And she is a terrific person, and they've got a good chemistry. So to steal something you said yesterday when you were talking with us, Maduro is about the only dictator or autocrat that he hasn't completely embraced, except maybe Diaz-Canel in Cuba as well, but that's kind of two sides of the same coin. So while he is embracing these dictators, while he is believing what they say over what his intelligence community says, he is disparaging U.S. allies. He has called Justin Trudeau weak and dishonest. He has criticized Theresa May's negotiating skills on Brexit. She didn't follow his advice. Clearly, that's why things fell apart. Tweets about Macron being hugely unpopular in France. Says Germany is captive to Russia. And calls the EU a foe. So an embrace of autocrats and dictators, a rejection of our allies. And what he is doing is emboldening these dictators and these autocrats, because we are, for the most part, turning a blind eye to what they are doing internally. Look at Saudi Arabia, right? Look at the killing of a U.S. resident that has received no attention from Trump. Now, he will call out, if he can use human rights as a cudgel, as they're trying to do a bit with China, right? U.S. residents are likely among those who are being detained in the Uyghur concentration camps. So they're talking about that, but they're not talking about it in Saudi Arabia. So that I find quite troubling. And I can, you know, we can get more into the Putin stuff, but I'd like to hear.
So let me just ask something here. Have we become, like, desensitized to this stuff? Because we hear it every day. And have the American people just say, okay, well, that's just the way it is. That's just the way Donald Trump is. And we just got to go along.
I don't know if I'd say desensitized. It's just waiting for what's next, right? I mean, how much lower can it go? I don't think it's that people, and I hope it's that people don't care what's happening. It's what do you do about it and what's next, right? I mean, every morning I get up, check my New York Times headlines just to see what the crisis of the day is and who we've made mad.
Well, we did that before
insulted.
We came in here.
We were all literally like around our phones saying, did we miss anything in like the last hour? It's that constant. It doesn't stop, but I desperately hope people aren't desensitized.
Go ahead, Connie.
I think that Jackie's right on the money, but I'm going to just be a devil's advocate. Nobody's been able to solve the situation with North Korea. No one. There have been, you know, treaties that haven't been implemented, and I'm hoping that when Trump was on the phone with Putin, that was a focus in the sense of Russia has just, you know, met with North Korea and seemingly is supporting them in the direction that they're taking. So North Korea is a terribly difficult situation. Saudi Arabia, we have always supported Saudi Arabia. This is really bad now, but we have been one of their most staunchest allies. And for me, even though the whole Khashoggi thing was just horrendous, I think that people are a little bit more awake and aware that this is not a country that we should be allied with. And but we have, you know, been an ally of theirs for a very long time, and they have had a version of Sharia law in place for a long time, and they basically cut off people's heads, and ISIS is not too far removed from the kind of law that they've been implementing in terms of human rights. So in terms of Erdogan, Erdogan and Obama had a fairly good relationship. Now, Turkey's gone in a new direction, and I'm not so sure Obama would still have, you know, supported him. But we were seeing Turkey quite a long time as kind of a middle power in the Middle East that we could work with. So foreign policy is really an area in which you do things, most presidents do things that are definitely good, bad, and ugly. And it's not easy to be consistent, even if you're a great power, and it's harder now because we are no longer hegemonic. Both Russia and China are extremely important, and I think people in the United States kind of get this, but we need to be following foreign affairs with much, much greater care and getting into the details, because we just assume we can get what we want. And anyway, so that's my devil's advocate.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, super quick response. This is not, I will not criticize Trump for having these conversations with these autocrats and dictators, right? Diplomacy is not about talking to your friends, right? It's about talking to the people that have interests that diverge from yours. North Korea has bedeviled every U.S. administration. It's not surprising that this one would be different. And when Trump said that he was going to meet with Kim, I thought, good, right? We need to have these talks. But to say that Kim loves his people, is doing good for the country, and that is being heard by the North Korean people, that's the problem I have. And to go into a summit and be completely unprepared and to assume that, given your skills as this amazing world-class negotiator, that Kim is just going to give up his entire nuclear program because you're the, you know, it's the deal of the century. It's the arrogance that he went in with, what he said, and the complete lack of success in Singapore and even worse in Hanoi that actually have increased tensions. We've seen North Korean missile tests over the last 4 days when we haven't seen them in a year or so. So yes, we talk to, and yes, talk to Putin. And if Putin wants to talk about arms control, for God's sake, let's do that. But let's do it right.
Michael.
Yeah, so it's clearly not a new thing that the United States balances its values and its interests in foreign policy. But I think there are three things that maybe differentiate this administration's approach. The first, and this has been alluded to, is that these are not just sort of alliances of convenience based on realpolitik. It's this sort of hearty embrace of, you know, some pretty despicable characters, and Kim is probably top of that list. The second is that there's not even a pretense of using these relationships to try to push for greater respect for human rights. So I remember being in Panama with Secretary Kerry. You know, we had like a down moment before he gave a speech, and he was on the phone with Sisi trying to advocate for somebody who was like, had been thrown in jail in Egypt, right? So like, you know, we were closer to Sisi than I would have liked us to be, but at least we were using that proximity to advocate for human rights. And I don't see much of that happening with this administration. And then the third thing is the deep aversion, especially since John Bolton became national security advisor to multilateral institutions, means that some of the kind of institutional checks that we spent, you know, the better part of 60, 70 years helping to build are being weakened, not by by the Chinas and Russias, but also now to some extent by the United States, whether it's the International Criminal Court or the Human Rights Council or the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. I mean, there are things that institutions that are that pose a sort of a check on the authoritarian impulses of some of these governments that we put a lot of time and effort into creating, and now we're kind of in some ways at the forefront of weakening them, and at the very least not, you know, not helping them kind of do the job that they were set up to do. So I do think there is a, while there are strains of this that are not dissimilar from prior administrations, there are also some things that are noticeably worse.
I want to mention to my staff folks here, I was supposed to have an iPad for the questions. Is that coming? All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. I don't have one, so what the heck. Let me ask you about what is really a growing movement of populism, can't even say it very well, and authoritarian governments. We're seeing that a lot. We were just talking about some of these, but also we're seeing it in a way that I think suddenly, is it growing more than we has in the past? Or Michael, why don't you address that?
So I come at this from a sort of a Latin American perspective, and I think Latin America claims to have sort of invented populism. It's like, it's certainly not a new thing in the region, but we're, you know, there was a sense, I think, that maybe it was in the past, and it's come kind of roaring back, most prominently probably in Brazil and Mexico, which are the two biggest countries in the region. These leaders are tapping into some of the things we talked about, here in the United States, which is, a sense that the political system is not responding. And so you have these kind of anti-establishment leaders, even ones that have been around for a while in their political systems, but they managed to kind of cast themselves as running against the system, tapping into frustration with corruption, with crime, with kind of stagnant economies, or at least economies that are leaving a significant piece of the population behind. And I think there's a danger there. I don't want to overstate this. The number of democracies in the world right now is about as high as it's ever been. I would struggle to say we're living in an environment where democracy is on the defensive. At the same time, Freedom House finds that for 13 years running, civil liberties and political rights in the world have been on the decline. So there's sort of this tension, and I think it speaks to the rise of these kind of illiberal democratic or soft authoritarian leaders like a Bolsonaro in Brazil who come to office clearly democratically and operate in a democratic system but aren't particularly interested or sort of impatient with some of the checks and balances and niceties of democracy. And that can end up sort of turning out okay, if institutions are robust enough to hold them accountable and to push back, and you sort of, you know, you get through it, or it can devolve into something like we've seen in Venezuela, which is, you know, over the course of a couple of decades, what had been a pretty robust democracy, if an imperfect one, turns into a dictatorship.
One thing that we don't seem to talk about very much is Africa. And kind of, I know that's an area that you focus on. We have seen, I think, some movement there in efforts to bring democracy to Sudan recently, although that still seems to be whether, again, you're having the military kind of in the way there as far as the civilian population wanting to bring a stronger democracy. Why do we tend to forget Africa, or we just ignore it?
I think that because Africa has less wealth than many other parts of the world, it is a place that we don't cover as well. We also have, the United States has a traditional relationship with Latin America going back for quite a long time. But there is almost a mini Arab Spring taking place right now. And maybe that would be the wrong term, because you have, in the last couple of years, a new government in Ethiopia. Abiy Ahmed, who made a peace with Eritrea, who has advocated for new media rights within the country and has recently been celebrated for having protected freedom of the press. It's a new direction. He's from the dominant ethnic group in Ethiopia, and they haven't had a president from that group for a very long time. Bouteflika in Algeria has been pushed out of office, and he basically was incredibly ill, and he wasn't really functioning, and it was really his brother who was running the government, but it really took lots of protests and marches and a political social movement of some scale to get him out. And this morning, I just noticed that they've arrested his brother and some of his associates. And Enrique mentioned Sudan, which looks like it's not just going through a political movement, but that there's been some incredible relaxation of the role of the police. And, I mean, this could be kind of the sort of thing that happens when a revolution takes place, so you go through a period of great freedom, but it's really impressive. So we have several countries that in which people are quite aware. The people are quite aware that democracy is an important, should be an important feature of political life in their country. And I actually think a lot of international issues are dropping off the table right now. And I just want to say quickly, I think we should think about Trump less. If the media would cover Trump, all of the media, MSNBC, Fox, everybody, half again is less, and look at some of the things that are happening. Well, Brexit, and the British just had an election, and the Conservatives lost 1,800 seats locally. So it's quite clear that people get that they're failing miserably in terms of their policies. Anyway, so you can tell that I'm somewhat optimistic on many developments, but I don't disagree with what's been said about the Trump administration in a general respect, and it's disturbing.
I had a question. Let me go to some questions here, if I can power this thing up. Hold on here. Okay. What are the implications of the arrest of Julian Assange, and how do we navigate this legal territory? Anybody want to weigh in on that one? It's an easy question, isn't it?
It's Ecuador, so it's Michael's.
Yeah, it's Michael's fault.
I thought it was UK.
Yeah. Anybody want to jump in on that?
I think the best I can do is try to regurgitate the smartest kind of legal commentary I've seen. So the perspective from which I think we should be most sort of interested in this is the whole question of, you know, does indicting Julian Assange pose a threat to free speech? And the argument being, if all that WikiLeaks did was report information, publicize information that had been classified, that is no different than what the New York Times and other journalistic entities do. And so it is, you know, under that kind of premise, the indictment would be a threat to free speech. And we know that the DOJ has had lots of sort of debates and discussions about this. And ultimately, what he's indicted for is not the release of that information, of the publication of that information. It's for a specific kind of hacking charge. And so that, I think, is reassuring. It reflects that over the course of two administrations, you know, Obama and now Trump, the Department of Justice came to the conclusion that there needed to be kind of a continuing safe harbor for, you know, journalists to do their job, as long as it doesn't get into, you know, conduct that clearly would be illegal. Apparently, I haven't looked closely at the indictment itself, so, you know, so that's, you know, a significant caveat. But there have been some concerns raised about the conduct that's described in the indictment, even if ultimately the charge is for the for hacking, describes some things that national security reporters do. So there are, you know, I wouldn't say that there are no concerns there, but certainly I was relieved when I saw the particular charge that it, you know, we didn't cross a line in terms of indicting somebody for simply, you know, reporting information that had been classified.
This is another question here, and this is from Haley. How do economic factors play into Trump's relationships with authoritarian regimes in other countries, such as China, Saudi Arabia, et cetera?
Well, for China, I think it's pretty central, right? I mean, this is a huge economic relationship, and the trouble for the U.S. with China is we're trying to balance this economic relationship that we have with them with China's rise, right? They are becoming a global competitor to the U.S., not just economically anymore. So Trump says really nice things about Xi, but they still slap on the tariffs, right? So even saying these nice things about the dictators, when it's come to these, you know, economic interests, that's winning out for Trump here. And, you know, keep in mind the tariffs that he has slapped on and the retaliatory moves that the Chinese have done, right? It's actually costing the U.S. about $40 billion a year. It's not affecting China as much as it's affecting us. You know, with Russia, it's Russia and the U.S. do not have a big economic relationship. We export about $7 billion worth of goods to Russia every year and import about $17 billion, right? That's not even like top 10. So, it's not just about economics when it comes to these relationships. I couldn't get into the details on Saudi Arabia. I don't know if anyone else can.
Yeah.
I guess I'd say, though, that one of the weird things, if you are someone who is bothered by the politics of the Trump administration in general, one of the weird things is he is kind of a realist. So Russia, which many American presidents have been in the making of foreign policy, so Russia isn't important economically, but it's hugely important in a security sense. And yeah, Saudi Arabia's, that's been one of the reasons we've had a sustaining relationship with them, is because of oil. But I guess I would agree both with Jackie and Michael that there's something else going on for the Trump administration in terms of the way that they narrate human rights and the almost casual anti-democratic values that they put on the table. So you have the embrace of religion as a basic, maybe God did anoint Trump, wasn't that in North, in the case of North Korea, to play a special role. Nobody saw that, huh?
I think I heard amazing. Something like that. God was having a bad
Secretary
day.
Secretary of
maybe,
State. Huh? Really.
Pompeo talking about Trump.
This was
yeah.
very seriously done. Yeah. So I guess I'll just say that the ideology and the ideas that are put forward currently representing the United States are a huge break in how we want to present ourselves. And it does do a lot of damage, and it undermines human rights groups across the world who depend on the United States to be at least doing behind closed doors diplomacy. But in an interest-based sense, some things are not that different. I guess that's what I'll say.
I want to get in a couple more questions here. This is from someone called Omaha. Do you think that Russia purposely forced Maduro to stay in Venezuela to create more immigration problems for the U.S.?
Wow.
That's a good one. I like that.
Yeah.
We haven't even really talked about immigration. You know?
I'll just say Trump and Pompeo seem to disagree on what Russia did in Venezuela. So
yeah.
So, you know, to the specificity of that, Russia is in Venezuela to mess with the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's that simple. We've messed around in their backyard. It's yes. how Trump feels. So he's got a chance to do it in ours. I don't think Russia or Putin is especially enamored of Maduro himself. I don't think they want to see him personally stay in office, but what they don't want to see is a U.S.-supported leader come in. Russia doesn't have huge economic interests, right? I don't think the economics explains it for Venezuela. Couple of gas fields, you know, some interest in a couple of oil fields. They're building two factories in Venezuela, one to make Kalashnikovs and one to make the ammunition for the Kalashnikovs. And what, Venezuela signed like half of Citgo over to Russia as a guarantee for a $1.5 billion infusion of cash. So Russia has some economic stakes in Venezuela, but it's not enough to explain it. And what Russia is doing in Venezuela is entirely consistent with their foreign policy strategy, which is basically to screw things up for the United States where it can. We allow them to do that sometimes, like we did in Syria. Left that opening for Russia to come in, and Russia is back as a power in the Middle East. We have done the same thing in Latin America, right? Trump's trip last year to Latin America, to Buenos Aires for the G20, was his first time going to Latin America. You know, Trump now getting involved in North Korea. We screwed up North Korea. There's an opening for him. Trump, Russia is in Israel-Palestine negotiations now. They're going to counter Trump's deal of right. the century with a Russian-led peace process. So this is, it's not just about the economics for Venezuela. It's not just about, you know, helping grow the immigration crisis there. It's just about stocking it to the U.S. wherever and whenever they can.
I'm going to end with this, and it may seem like a kind of a simplistic question, but I just have to throw it out there. Why should we care about foreign policy and foreign affairs?
You like that one? So
I just thought up of
that's a good one.
Give me a round of applause or something. I don't know.
Since, you know, since I run the World Affairs Council, I've really got nothing to say on this.
Yeah. You only got 2 minutes.
So if you care about democracy, human rights, and securing long-term peace and prosperity in the United States and abroad, then you have to care about foreign policy, and you have to care about what we do, and you have to care about what we say, and you have to care about where we say it.
Michael, I'm sorry.
I'll be short and sweet, too. I mean, what the U.S. does in the world matters, and I've seen that as somebody who's worked for a long time in Latin America on issues of human rights and democracy, but also as an immigrant to this country. It's something that I feel very sort of strongly and personally, and it's why I chose the career that I chose, because we have a unique capacity in this country to really make the world a better place, as kind of corny as that may sound, but it's been my personal and professional experience. So
many countries are doing things that we would like to do much better, and we're not aware of it. We talk about healthcare in this country like we kind of invented this issue, and the Europeans and the Latin Americans and some parts of Asia already have universal healthcare. I just, by kind of accident, not that I travel so frequently to Europe, but I was in Paris when the Obama's bill was passed, and they had a panel on France 24, which is an English language French station, and people just laughed. I mean, they said, why would anybody in the United States be against providing basic health care? And so one of the things is some of the ideas and the things that matter to you, if you study more about the world and other people's perspectives, and not just culture, but the politics of other countries, it's not just useful in some vague intellectual sense. It will really grow the way you approach the political world. And so I think it's looking at foreign policy is just at the center of things.
Thank you. I just want to thank all of you for crowding in here to listen to this, but also because I think it shows that you care about what's happening in the world, and we all should. And thank you very much for being here today at the Crosscut Festival. Thank you to the panel. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Victoria Ralph and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And for the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And just a reminder to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Baumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.